Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why episode 281, my chat with comedian and podcaster Ivy Lee. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts, including this one. You can listen to Yes But Why through the Audible app. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. Mention code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. We can help. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is my resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. Check out TrueHempScience.com for all the CBD products available to you now. Use code YESBUTY7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. Plus, you'll get a free packet of CBD edibles with your order. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I chat with Ivy Lee, Vietnamese-American comedian and creator of the Spotify podcast Fogo, Fear of Going Outside. Listen in as we talk about writing, podcasting, and dancing. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 281, Ivy Lee and the Road to Making Fogo, Fear of Going Outside, a nature show by the most reluctant host ever. Enjoy! Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah. So I wanted to start by asking you about what kind of a creative kid were you? I really think that kids have, you know, their creativity inside them and express it as purely as possible before the world, you know, muddies it up. But what was it that you played with when you were a kid?
Oh, I try to block out as much of my childhood as I can. So think about that.
All right.
I think the world got to be pretty early. My parents came to America in 1980 as refugees, and I was the first one born in the States. And so I think a lot of my creativity just came from making do, just from that perspective of making do with what you've got.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was super into crafts because then I could make things for myself that I could use. My grandmother taught me how to sew. She sewed all my pajamas for me and a lot of my clothes at home. And I was terrible at it, you know, but it kept a little kid probably out of her hair for at least 20 minutes at a time when I tried to make something for a doll or a stuffy or something like that. Wow. And I was really preoccupied with language. I read a lot because I was trying to get those food gift certificates for my family, like those like free pizzas and passes at Brahms, the ice cream shop here in Texas.
Yeah.
And I had a very, very all-consuming fear that if I didn't read everything, I read billboards, candy wrappers, I mean, literally everything. Everything that came in our mail, coupons. I had this like fear that because I could speak English, if something really important were to happen and we didn't know about it, it would be because I didn't read it and I did not, you know, ring the alarm on that. And
whoa.
So I read. Yeah.
Whoa, so, what a weight on your shoulders.
But it gave me this drive. Like I was just I'm really preoccupied with words and languages, and now I'm grown and now I'm not worried about those things, but now I speak four languages and I still read everything. I still read everything. And I think that that really was kind of, I think the thing about writing is that it was the one thing I could compete with at school, that it did not matter if I had money or not.
Hmm. Yeah.
But like there's just like, you know, you can't in the arts. I remember when I was a senior in high school, I was in the art program. Yeah, I wasn't a band nerd or a theater nerd because those things like cost money and time, you know,
yeah.
But I was in the visual arts. That was my extracurricular. That was my elective. And they're just these kids who they just could bring in the coolest supplies and make the most incredible things. And you're just sitting there like, man, I often have thought about what if what if I did just go to Parsons and somehow magically come into the money for the supplies and the tuition? Would my life be different? Or would have just ended up back as a word person anyway, or if I would have just stayed as a word person anyway. So who knows? But, you know, other people, they can't, you know, libraries are free, paper and pencils are, you know, cheap. You can reuse the backs of all the junk that gets sent to your house. Like, you don't need to have money to become a great writer. So I pursued, I thought that I would just be a writer one day when I grew up. And I, turns out, writing is not very lucrative.
Yeah, super sorry that didn't work out for you.
So I said,
oh, goodness.
Okay, I'm going to go into, I think that storytelling has really, the kind of the now that you're making me reflect on my early childhood, you know, you didn't warn me it was going to get this deep. I saw so much injustice growing up.
Yeah.
And I was very naive. I still believed in people. I thought people were like nice and good. And I believed in all the things that they teach you in school about, you know, Thanksgiving and Abraham Lincoln. And they still teach all those things. I didn't believe what they taught me about Columbus. I knew Columbus was shady from the jump. I remember arguing with my second grade teacher, being like, this guy sounds like a dick. I don't know why you're teaching me about him.
No.
I feel like he didn't do anything. I feel like he just got lost and did these terrible things, and you're making me write an essay about how great he is, and I refuse. But so I knew that one was shady, but everything else kind of about the ideals of America, I really, you know, believed in. And I just thought, reading the newspapers because I was scared that I would miss something from my family, reading them. And I remember reading these stories and thinking, geez, I wish they had asked someone in my neighborhood or someone at my school or one of my teachers, because we wouldn't have said either of these two sides of the issue that they're quoting here. You know, I don't know where they're finding these people, because people in my neighborhood think something really different from either. You know, it's always just two sides in these stories, you know. And I think I thought, well, if I just go to college and I studied political science and journalism, if I just go to college and learn how to tell these stories, once people know, they'll just want to fix it. You know, like I was a kid and I was just like, I think people just don't know what's going on in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think they're not helping us because they just don't know. That turned out to be wrong. People absolutely knew, but they did not want to, but to fix these things requires extreme inconvenience to people who where things are not wrong in their neighborhoods. So that's what happened. But that just gave me a drive to tell stories. I consumed American television because my parents obviously worked all the time, but also because I was trying to learn English. So I am obsessed with American television. I love American television. I love trashy reality shows. I love the swaggering American action movie, and I want to write those movies, but I want to populate them with the characters that were from my real life, the badass women that are the real reason why I get to be who I am. That, you know, I feel like men, like, they have like muscle and they want to be, you want to have one around to avert trouble. But like when actual trouble comes, you need women. You need women who are trained from like age 9 to be ready to kill somebody. You know what I mean? You need women who, you know, through like the Whisper Network in the South, like know how to dispose of a body. Like you know what I mean? You need women who like secretly know how to like give stitches and avoid the hospital if necessary, and like do procedures at home if the world, you know, if the world demands that kind of resourcefulness. And I want to populate these movies with those things. But writing is actually very stressful, and it was extremely underpaid. And so I always had to do writing, whether it was poetry or spoken word or writing for magazines. You know, like I'm here in Austin with you. I was the beer reporter at the Austin Chronicle for a while when I first moved here. Those things don't pay well. So I always had to do a day job, like, you know, a for-profit day job on top of it. And then on top of all that, to do kind of the narrative activism and changing hearts and minds that I think it takes to see the world that I want to see, after I realized that it wasn't just that people didn't know. And people weren't helping, not just because they just didn't know. They totally knew. Well, then, you know, then we need to address kind of these root causes and these really terrible narratives that we've built around people who are oppressed. And so then it's like I'm trying to carry all three of these things because I couldn't afford not to, right? But I'm finally at a place where, just because of an accident of technology and a coincidence of the cultural zeitgeist, that I'm able to do all of these things. I have a day job in the nonprofit narrative change, you know, world. And I, for the first time in my life, I found my genre. I'm in comedy now. I think for a long time, I didn't think comedy was for me because I didn't see it, because it was just not, I didn't see people in any way like me sharing experiences in any way that I could relate to. And so I thought, oh, I have to be like a poet, you know, but in the past just few years, like, that's dramatically changed. Like Ali Sadiq and Nanette, oh my god, I can't believe I can't remember her name off the top of my head. Hannah Gadsby, wait, and Ali Sadiq changed my life, because when I saw what they were doing, I said, oh, wait a second, if what they're doing is comedy, then forget, it doesn't even matter if they're the only two people doing it. They're not, right? But those are the ones that the first time I saw them kind of bubble to in my media world, so I could actually see it, right? Because I wasn't looking for it, because I didn't think comedy would have any room for someone like me. When I saw those things, I'm like, if what they're doing is comedy, then absolutely there's room for me. Doesn't even matter who else is in it. If what they just did is this genre, then this genre is for me. And when I decided that, it was at the time, the reason why they were kind of bubbling up is because there has never been so much respect or demand for comedy until now. And I'm like, oh, these things that make something funny, they're just other literary devices. I already know how to write. I learned how to write since I was a kid. Now I'm just using these new literary devices to tell the stories that I want to tell. And then at the same time, the media landscape is changing. So before, when I was a kid, I thought, oh, I would have to get a book deal from these, you know, three publishers or whatever, you know. And today, my book deal, so I never got the book deal. What I got was a podcast deal from Spotify Studios. And that was my book deal, with the book advance and with the, you know what I mean? And with the partnership with the publisher and all that kind of stuff. But like, obviously I couldn't dream of something like that when I was a kid, because this media didn't exist. These streaming services like Netflix did not exist. And so now I just had to like wait. I feel like there's a process of me becoming, but also a process of just that timing matching what was happening in the world that I obviously had no control over.
Yeah. Before, you said that you never saw a place for yourself in comedy. What were you like going to do? Like, what was the plan before you saw the comedy and were like, hold on, wait, that is going to fit with what I want to do much better. But what was the previous plan? Like, what were you working towards writing wise? Like novels or, you know, performance pieces?
Yeah, I think I was still trying to find that place. I tried everything. You know, I've done storytelling shows. I've done spoken word shows. I've done improv. More recently, after I discovered comedy, I've been doing a lot of stand-up. But I was definitely, you know, putting out these proposals to editors at magazines and newspapers to tell the stories that I didn't see being told. You know, that kid Ivy was like, I wish they asked somebody in my neighborhood. An adult Ivy who went to journalism school can ask an editor to be like, hey, I want to write a story and I'm going to interview these people that none of your people are interviewing. Like, so now I'm an adult. I don't have to wonder why. I would just go and do it and try to uplift these marginalized stories and let people tell the stories for themselves instead of being filtered through the white gaze.
Yeah. You mentioned you went to journalism school. Did that lead to work in journalism, or are these pitches that you're sending you as a freelance journalist trying to get like just a, you know, story with this group and then a story with another group?
It would be both. So the journalism degree helped me get my day job in public relations.
Right on.
Right. And of course, even in the capacity of public relations, you're obviously representing your clients who are largely corporations. But then I develop these relationships with these journalists, and I can also, you know, get them people from my neighborhood, the people I wish that they had access to. But social circles are hard to break out of your social circles, right? Like any journalist or anybody who has to get a bunch of leads, they, you know, call whoever is easiest and then ask them for other names and then ask those people for other names. But eventually, right, then what if you're asking people who have no connections to power whatsoever? You're not going to be able to find those people. They're insulated in another part of the world, just like, you know, in your own city, you know, sometimes. And it can be hard to get those names and find those stories if you're not used to it, if you don't have that lived experience. And so I would kind of be able to help reporters do that, but mostly during the day job, I was telling the stories of my clients. And then I was like moonlighting as a reporter.
So the moonlighting again was just like you found a story that you wanted to tell, and then you sort of put together, this is what I'm going to write, and tried to sell it to different newspapers. I ask because like I legitimately don't know what the path of like a writer who's a freelance writer is. Like, is that how you do it?
Yeah. So it's kind of like a mini book proposal. So if you can pitch a magazine, you can pitch a magazine editor and say, hey, you know, just kind of explain, this is the article that I would like to write. These are the sources that I'm thinking I'm going to be able to use. I would like this piece to be approximately 500 or 2000 or 3000 words or 700 words or something like that. Best regards, thanks for your consideration, you know, and so it's more complex than a little more detailed than a pitch that a publicist would use. Like a PR person pitches a reporter and says, hey, I think this story has news value. Here's some angles, but obviously I'm not the reporter. I don't presume to know what angle your readers and your editors will find interesting. But I would like to offer you these resources, and probably you're working on something in this neighborhood. If you would like these resources, that's what a PR person does. A reporter or a freelance, you know, writer says all of those things, like, hey, but is much more specific. this is the research I've done. These are the sources I found. I discovered this nugget of things. This would be breaking news, or this would be a new angle on something that's already being discussed, or these are new sources that haven't been heard from before. And this is the arc that I think the story would take. It might, who knows, once I talk to people, it might take a different arc, of course. But you know, here's what I have to offer, and here are some writing clips. I am a seasoned writer who can deliver on time. Would like to work with you. Thank you for your consideration. And then they take it or they don't take it. Most magazines and newspapers and weeklies will have a section on their website where they accept submissions for that sort of thing.
Awesome. Thank you for letting me know. Sometimes there are moments when somebody does something and I'm like, hey, I've never known how a person does that. So tell me, because I'm sure somebody listening is like, I would like to do that. So yeah, great. That's awesome. That's like such an interesting path. Is that something that you learned from like your experience working with the PR firm? Like, oh, hey, you get a letter and everybody's like, this one's a good one. So you're like keeping this one to make sure I look like this, right? Or is it like journalism school is so good at teaching you what you need to do in the real world? Because like, to be honest with you, I have a theater degree. Wasn't so helpful on like what actually happens in the real world, right? Do I know a lot about Shakespeare? Yes. Yes, I do. But does that help me to get an acting job in even Shakespeare? No, it does not. Right.
Doesn't? Okay.
No.
I'm not going to go to theater school. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hey, you know, at this point, what I've learned over the years is that there are a lot of awesome small conservatories all across the country and the world, even where like you don't have to do a thing like go to Yale Drama School to like be at a really important, or like Juilliard. You just need to find the group of people that make you feel like you are the most comfortable, because once you feel the most comfortable, you then are able to bloom and put your stories out there and like open yourself up to it, versus, you know, the time to harken back to your own story, you know, when you feel super protective, you don't want to tell anybody what's going on because you're concerned for what, you know, the survival element is the most important in the moment. And it's not about being able to be creative, but when you are able to get into a spot where you feel comforted and you have a team around you that feels like, okay, people have my back, you know, then you can really creatively bloom.
I want to find that place. Amy, will you help me find these acting schools? Because look, I'm only writing scripts because if I don't, I'm going to be stuck playing cool, silent Asian hacker for the rest of my life. And that is not what I want to play. But if other people would just write the movies that I want to play, then that would be great. I think being the actor who just gets to show up after all the story's been broken and leaves before all the editing has to be done is ideal. That is my ideal job. Writing is so stressful. But, you know, if you're, this is just the generation of representation that I'm in. If I don't write, the world will not change. But if other people would do it, I would rather be lazy. And
sounds like you need to start the school then, because you don't want to do it. You want other people to. So now you need to get your like army of people to take care of it. Be like,
I want to go to acting school.
Sure. Sure. Definitely.
Like, I would like to act in there. I'm like so mad that Shang-Chi happened before I could be established and represented.
No, to your point of being in the zeitgeist when everything's worked out, I would say it's actually, don't be mad, because it's really laying some serious groundwork in a way that there are likely to be a lot more movies that have Asian leads, especially from the point of view of like, recently I noticed a series of tweets from the actor about how he did like photo shoots when he was younger, like like, oh, and I was like, man, so all funny. Of us do this crazy stuff though. Like, that's the beauty of this full journey, right? Is that like, sometimes you're like, oh man, what can I do? What's that? A modeling shoot? Yeah, let's do it. I mean, like, I did a series of photos 6 months before the pandemic that are still popping up and people are like, is this you? Yes. Yes, it is. You know what I mean? Like, that's the beauty of working, right? Just doing different kinds of things. And even someday when you are the definitely talking Asian hacker in the movie, they'll be like, man, did you see that girl in the movie? She was great. Did you know she has a podcast? What? Let's listen to it too. Right. Like, you know, the beauty of being a true creative is that you're going to do what happens in the moment. Like you said, you did all the reading, you soaked it all up, you learned all the languages, which, P.S., didn't even talk about that because the story kind of continued, but like, whoa, that's a lot of languages to learn, like, and totally reinforces this idea of you're like steeping yourself in words, like not even just English words, right? Nope. Other languages. Like, I believe, what was it? Did you recently visit Germany and you can speak German? Like, what? Yeah. That's amazing. Like, you got yourself involved in that sort of creative thing because that's what was interesting you in the moment, right? Nothing wrong with that. You're later in life. I look forward to seeing you in movies. You're going to be great. It's going to be wonderful. In fact, the people that are listening to this, guys, when you're writing your movies, check Ivy out. She'd be a great lead, right? Absolutely. And as far as acting schools, guys, call me. We'll get this hooked up, right? But we'll talk specifics on that later. So your path, though, in journalism school led you to your PR job. Did that, like, equip you with the business sense to continue the way you have? I mean, before we started recording, you were talking as such a smart businesswoman. I should have started taking notes then about like podcasting and being organized and like keeping yourself on it as a business. I'm like, oh man, I've been doing this for a long time and I am not as organized as that. And I like, how did you get that business sense to like be organized and like keep it working and like get yourself? You just seem so like it's a complete business and you're running it as such right now.
Yeah. I mean, it has to be. I think when you're because people like me don't get the shot until you've made the whole thing. Do you know what I mean? There's so many distributors now who are trying to get all this credit for being so woke. But when these movies that they pick up at these film festivals, at these prestigious film festivals, when they pick them up, those directors had pitched them the film and they passed. And then those directors had to go raise the money themselves and find this talent that they always knew was there, but Hollywood says, you know, is not marketable or whatever. And then once they did all that on their own dime and their own resources, then the distributor says, oh, okay, now we'll pick it up. We have to make those opportunities for ourselves. And in order to do that, you have to run it like a business because the big business is not interested in representation if it, you know, makes them have to change who their gatekeepers are and how they do their business. And that's just the reality. And that's not just entertainment. That's every industry. Every industry has these problems. Every time there's these programs, and I've been in so many of these little diversity initiatives, you know, but it's like they're always like the Hunger Games. We're like, we only get like our publishing company is going to pick the person of color children's book we're going to publish this year. But you don't get to compete in the pile with everybody else. You have to compete with each other for the Hunger Games, you know, and then we're still, and then we're gonna, but, and then if you win, it's like a reality show, like, and if you win, we have like the rights to everything and you, we will not negotiate with you like we would with everybody else if we let you compete. So these diversity initiatives, they always assume something's wrong with me instead of their gatekeepers.
Yeah.
And we have all these initiatives in Hollywood, like the Blacklist, which is incredible. It was an incredible solution to the problem. I think in the short term, but if somebody can top the blacklist, right? And great. I hope that person goes and gets representation. I hope they get their movie made, and I hope that launches their, you know, career or whatever. But if it took the blacklist to get a person of color, you know, representation, what's wrong with your agents that they weren't able to find this talent? The talent is obviously there, like in copious, absurd amounts, right? But what's wrong with your agents that they're not able to find them? What's wrong with your studio that they weren't even attempting to look for them before an effort like the blacklist, you know, was made up? It's not that these writers were missing anything or have to be in some program to be taught how to format things, you know. It's because your gatekeeping system is flawed and you're keeping out really great talent and putting through really mediocre things just because they don't seem as risky, because they're just like everything that you've ever seen before, which is obnoxious to audiences.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if they're, hopefully there will be a lot of, you know, changes in Hollywood going forward, not only just because of, like, you know, this current cultural climate in which people are, you know, pointing the finger at, like you're saying, this problem where it's like, no, you don't have to limit how many, you know, people of color get to be on this, as if somehow, you know, we don't have the right to. We're actually better writers than some of the people on here, and I don't know how they're getting these kinds of jobs, right? I get that they went to the fancy rich school and took the internship and, like, now they're in, but it's like, you know, at the end of the day, especially with creative stuff, I'm like, don't we want there to be better people out there, like better actors, better, like, writers, better stories, right? We're holding ourselves back, if not. And I wonder if, like, as the generations move forward, and perhaps there can be an opening within the system of, you know, the studios and whatnot that have this gatekeeping, or I suppose there can just be new studios created and people are, exactly, like, not interested in trying to change hearts and minds when, as you mentioned earlier, they're not so easily changed. But, you know, just create a new system.
Yeah, that's what Shonda Rhimes did. That's what Issa Rae did.
Yeah.
Right. I take so much inspiration from all of these women of color, mostly Black women, who have found ways to make careers for themselves before me. And I'm basically studying their careers, consuming every interview about their careers that I can to find ways to move through the world on my own terms. Like in stand-up comedy, for example, I got small kids. I'm starting out in stand-up comedy, you know, damn near 40. I can't make it to the number of open mics that traditionally you would have to hit, you know, to be on the scene, because these open mics they're taking place during bedtime routines.
Yeah.
I cannot come and sign up in person. The pandemic helped a little bit. I think with the pandemic, more people were open to online signups generally. So there's a few more opportunities because of the pandemic, but I mean, not a lot more, right? Then you have to go up and go out and you have to weigh, well, you know, are the kinds of people who are willing to go out to these open mics right now, are they the kind of people who are gonna, you know, give my kids COVID if I go to these things because they don't care about the risk? Like, I don't know, right? It's complicated. It's just, yeah, a lot more complicated when you're a mom. So I had to find another way. So I got my show, FOGO, Fear of Going Outside, the podcast, you know, that's licensed by Spotify Studios. I got my comedy show before I got you know, any traditional comedy bookings. I was doing stand-up comedy in the form of storytelling routines at storytelling shows where that have a lot more lead time that you can audition for, you know, like Bedpost Confessions here in town, that sex positive storytelling show. I did a whole bit about sexuality after childbirth that brought down the house. Like, it was actually, that was kind of the first story I told. You can find it on their podcast. It's called, the episode's called Come to Me, Daddy. Where people came up to me afterwards and they didn't say you should try comedy. They assumed that I was already a working comedian because that's the way that my set was structured, right? And I had my second child and I had a really hard time getting back into the workforce. I was having a really hard time finding a job and it was getting bad. It was the amount of time that I had to find a job was basically over, and I was having to look at totally new careers to try to find something to do, so to just make even a little bit of money, you know, and that also worked with a childcare situation. And when people said, "Oh, I love going out for comedy in town. Where do you play?" I just heard, "Oh, are these people willing to give me money? I need to find a way to let them give me their money." I'm out of money. Like, I'm not getting these interviews. And that year, I made more money from comedy than from business consulting, or as much. I was freelancing, obviously, as a marketing consultant until I got to a full-time job. I had made as much money from comedy that year as business consulting. And since I didn't have a job lined up, I was like, I just need to build. I am in no position to reject career ideas at this point. I'm so desperate for a job. And that's when I started laying the groundwork for comedy while I was still, you know, applying for jobs, while I was still laying on the groundwork for the nonprofit work that I do as my day job, you know, and now, and it, obviously planting those seeds, it takes a long time for them to sprout, but I'm really glad that I did, because now I get to enjoy the fruits of both of those things.
Man, you're very inspiring when it comes to like how organized you seem and how like your plans, you know, like I like the idea of planting the seeds and then, you know, working them until they grow. It's like, yeah, man, I wish I had the patience for that kind of stuff. You're just so inspiring to me for, you know, putting the work in to lay the groundwork for comedy. And I say that from the point of view of a person who also has small children. My child has only just gone to school on a regular basis. So I have been mm-hmm. with him for a long time, right? And that that definitely takes up your time and energy in a way that makes doing other kinds of work really hard. So you telling me that you did both comedy and marketing consulting while also raising kids, and anyone who's not a parent might not grasp how much that is, but that is like a Herculean task of accomplishing anything. Doing one of those, if you did like 3 days a week marketing consulting and then the kids, I'd be like, whoa. But you're like, also, I did this comedy and this storytelling and this other work. And it's like, oh my God, the organization that goes into making all of that happen is absolutely insane. It is tough to have kids and to try to maintain this creative life. Like, how am I going to continue to do it? And I feel you.
Secret.
Go ahead.
The secret is a fear of poverty. That's the secret. No.
It kind of is. It definitely, it motivates me quite a bit. It motivates me quite a bit.
The secret is that you do not want your children to be out on the street. it's a very common thing, right? Like in America, to be the working, that's what it means to be working poor in the United States, is that we're like the hardest working unemployed people in the world, probably.
yeah, absolutely. You know what, though? Interestingly enough, I would say that the skills, I've said this before, but the skills that I have learned juggling stuff and figuring out how to make money when there's no money and like different things like that, how to be like, hi, bill collector, I'm not going to pay you. let's still be friends. And make that work.
Let me try. Let me try up the stand-up set for you if you just have 2 minutes.
Exactly. They're into it, right? And they're like, yes, ma'am, that was funny. However, we still need the $153.95. And you're like, cool, cool, cool. I got you. Now, the having to have dealt with that in my life prior to COVID, essentially knocking out my entire, all of the normal hustles that we have to make money, which were all creative. And in the world prior to COVID, it felt like I was in a movie and I was the person with a certain set of skills. Like something crazy happened and it was like, Amy has a certain set of skills and this situation that's occurred, she can handle it. Like, so there was like I immediately was just like, okay, this is where you get this. This is how you get them to buy your groceries. This is how, like, there were so many little things that I hadn't used for a little while or that I knew this, that, and the, and like they all went into high gear to take care for months when we just didn't have jobs, right? So yes, the secret of keeping yourself busy and hardworking is definitely the fear of poverty, but I feel like it also fuels into this like hardworking ability that you can do for yourself that is not dependent on some sort of boss being like, you better get those reports done by the end of the week, you know? And that in and of itself means that even with all the jobs, there's an independence that you have because you can take care of yourself. You have gone through these tough times and you have a stronger ability to do it. There are a lot of people that I knew where it was like COVID was the first time they had encountered a financial distress of any kind. And I was all like, you're going to make it through this. This is your first time. I'm sorry about that. It'll be okay. Like, it was wild to be in a position and be like, yeah, this has happened to me before. So let me tell you how to deal with negative $400 in your bank account. Like, for sure. But I still believe, even though we're joking and being real about, you know, how to make money when there's no money to be had, you have a determination, you have a confidence and something about you that really pulls it through. I don't think that your story as you tell it is, you know, like you overcame some tough times, but you have within you a capability that I'm sure you had even as a tiny child. I mean, like, because my kids, and I'm sure your kids too, you can kind of get their vibe early on, right? They can either take care of themselves or they'd like to lay down on a bed and have you do it for them, Caligula style, right?
You ever see your kid do something and you're like, not gifted?
I thought you were going to say, and this is what I think, you ever look at your kid and be like, oh man, that's me.
No. Crap. I have the opposite concern. I'm learning, you know, I want to break a cycle of intergenerational trauma. And obviously part of that is breaking a cycle of intergenerational poverty for my children. And, you know, by the skin of my teeth, I think we have succeeded. But I think I always assumed, you know, we're immigrants. Like the dialogue in the 80s and the 90s, and I mean, frankly, still a lot of people, is like, immigrants are only allowed to be here if they're perfect people.
Yeah.
Right. Only if they're absolutely perfect people, then they're allowed to stay. Then if they're not, like, they need to GTFO. And so there's that sense of like, well, you know, but I can be, you know, it's okay. I'm going to be this perfect person and earn my place here. And I think I thought that if I was able to unburden my children from trauma and poverty, that then they wouldn't have to deal with all these side quests that I had to deal with, and that they would be able to fly like further and be stronger and go faster and go higher, you know. But a lot of times people who don't have PTSD are just regular, schmegular, healthy people. And I am trying really hard to come to terms that my winning might look like that. And that's baggage I have to deal with, to be like, what if I do all this and my kids are just regular people? Like, they don't want to be president of the United States or anything like that. They just want to be regular, happy people with functional relationships. I don't know, doing dentistry or something. You know, like, what am I going to, am I going to be okay with that? Can I handle that? I don't know. So sometimes I look at my kids and I'm like, ugh, why aren't you more stressed out? Why do you feel so safe that you can say that to your mother? Oh, because I don't hit you. And it's, ooh, sometimes I want to.
You know, it is really hard because there is a, I feel like there is an ebb and flow in all society for everyone between having a hard upbringing and it being difficult and sort of clawing your way up. And then you're like, I'm not going to let that happen to my kids. And then when you raise these kids and they don't have the same kind of trials they had to go through, they don't learn the lessons. And you're like, why don't you know the value of a dollar? And be like, because you kept handing them to me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, no, I mean, think of, there's a bunch of people in this world that are like that, where it's like, they just never had to worry about money. So they don't, right? And it's like, no. Yeah, that's a thing that could go away in so many ways. So please be careful with that situation. Think of it like a bomb as you hold it. It's going to go off.
I don't want to romanticize struggle, you know, because it breaks people.
But I would say that the hard times in your life, even to harken back to what I was saying about what I learned about being poor and then dealing with it in COVID when we were like destitute, like, the idea of going through hard times is how we learn. The brain literally processes negative stimuli more and better and holds it tighter than it does with positive. Like, people can tell you every day how great you are. One person tells you you're shitty. You're thinking about that guy for your whole life. Like, it's just the way we process, right? And I'm not saying, like, put your kids in boot camp. They'll figure it out. But, like, you know, there is something, they will have to go through their own trials, whatever they might be, right? And we just can't take that away from them.
No, I don't think you should take all their challenges away from them. But I think the difference between, it's like when you work out, your muscles break and then you rebuild stronger. And that's a good workout.
Mm.
If you break a bone, it will never, ever, ever be as strong as it was before it broke. That's the difference between, I think, trauma and just regular challenges. So it's true that, you know, I was able to get some gifts from my upbringing. But it's also true that in my day jobs, usually I'm a level or two levels below somebody who is exactly my age with exactly my children, my children spaced apart, who did not have to do all the side quests that I had to do. And they're able to make a bigger impact on the world because they did have more privilege. Mm. They did have an easier life. But that's to the parent. I can't engineer that. It's like, I can only give them these skills. And if they choose to apply them in one way based on their values, or if they choose to, you know, they choose a less ambitious, but still equally valid and still a good life, you know, like, I need to just come to terms with that and accept that.
Yeah.
Can you hear them? They're like clawing at the door of my podcast closet right now.
I legitimately thought it was my own cats and husband. So it's okay. It's fine. Usually there's a cat literally meowing at the loudest possible. And you can hear it on almost all of the last four or five podcasts. And I'm like, but you know, life is life.
About what a good mom I am right now.
Oh, man. You know what, though? Motherhood is not something that people talk about enough with reference to creative work, and also with reference to, like, how do you navigate your own trauma? Like, we're all trying to grow up, become adults that can function, and find something in the world that can make us happy and create. And also, if you're inclined to do so, you know, maybe help the world a little bit, right? But motherhood is this like crazy full stop where it's like, are you ready to take 5 years off? You're into it. Like, and you have two kids. Like, I just have one. And I'm like, whoa.
Amy specifically means 5 years off of your lifespan for those of you.
Right. So motherhood is such a big thing that like messes with your creative flow. And I say that with all due respect to children and mothers and everything. It's just for me, I had to put a lot of things on stop. In fact, my entire podcast situation has become online like this because I had a kid like just in the other room taking a nap for most of, for like 2 years worth of podcasts. It's definitely that was the situation, right? Now it's like COVID and my connection to the international community has made it easier to do it this way, you know, through Zoom. But, you know, it was the only creative outlet I had during the early days of motherhood when I felt so distant from the world and I couldn't go to the theaters anymore and I couldn't teach improv classes and I couldn't go to open mics. And it was just like, I guess I just sit here. But I've found a way to turn this into like an, you know, an experience for both of us. You know, it's social time and it's also enriching conversations that hopefully get both of our creative juices flowing. And when people listen to it, hopefully it inspires them to do things as well, right? So I am so like I'm hearing you talking about you're such a strong mother and two kids. Woohoo! Ooh, a lot more than I'm dealing with.
You're like two times more than I do. It's not motherhood, right? It's not the fact that you got knocked up and it's not like that little squirt's fault that these hard things happen to you. It's society's fault that this is how we experience motherhood in America.
Yeah.
A motherhood in America is like, we're like, if you're extremely young and you're extremely old, you're not producing anything. So this society is just going to pretend that you do not exist. And then if you're the person who is legally and morally responsible for that unproductive person, right? Well, then you have to go into timeout with that little person too. And if you don't want to do that, well, you have to pay for the childcare. Like when couples in America, because we do not have affordable childcare like in other countries, and we do not have a community structure of taking care of the children like in a lot of other cultures, right? Because we are just like kind of every nuclear household for themselves.
Yeah.
When you go to look for a job, the assumption is that the daycare expenses come out of your salary. Did you have that child alone?
Yeah.
Is that child not going to become a productive member of this society and that this society will not benefit from it? Why does it only come out of your salary after tax? That math, it just places a burden on you that makes you think that they're trying to financially, economically represent that this is your burden. And I think how that kind of plays out in the arts is that because we're not thinking about how do we make the arts accessible for wherever artistic ideas might be found, that it took us hundreds of years to get, for example, Ali Wong's Baby Cobra. Okay, look, childbirth and parenthood is absurd and hysterical, right? But why did it take so long for us to get an entire comedy special about this inherently absurd thing that we have experienced since the beginning of time, before pre-civilization, right? When I know that women were joking about this. They were joking about their menstruation. I know they were joking about how gross childbirth was. I know they were making really dark jokes about people who have died in childbirth. I know since they first had language, we have been joking about this. Okay. But the reason why it took us so long to get this is exactly what she said in the special, is that as soon as you become a parent, comedy is like, oh, you can't be a comic anymore. You got to get out. you know, like we are not even going to make it so you can sign up for a mic. Like, you need to just leave. We don't want to hear it. And if you decide to stay, or if you're a person who might have children one day, we're going to stick a bunch of Louis C.K.'s on you. Right. I love and admire his work. Okay. Was he worth 5 Ali Wongs? No. Right. People are like, oh, we can't cancel these comedians. I'm like, you're just thinking about what you got. You're not thinking about the opportunity cost, because this field is so hostile to women. One of the first 3 comedy specials civilization should have had was about the absurdity of childbirth and parenthood, which is such an integral part of the human experience. But it was literally, it took us hundreds of years to get comedy from that. Or let's just say from the screen. So from the beginning of the silver screen is how long? I can't remember when it was invented. Mid-1800s, something like that.
Oh, I don't know.
So I think it's something like when we first got like moving pictures and people would go to theaters and, you know, and comedy, like they wanted to see things that made them laugh or scared them, you know, but like comedy was the thing that made that technology. Well, porn, first porn and then comedy, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Always, then, always.
Like, porn, things, right? That's kind of the order that makes these media platforms, this like new technology, like viable. So comedy was very early in all of that. So it took us, I think, about 170 years, if I'm ballparking mid-1800s, as when we got moving pictures, right, to get comedy about this, because we did all of these things to keep women out of it, because we didn't want women to compete. This like question of, are women funny? It's like, you know, they're funny. That's why you don't want them to compete.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're trying to keep away because you know that everybody would find them hilarious. Like, I'm sorry that you might not personally, but that doesn't mean that everybody doesn't, right? Yeah, I mean, it has been a landscape marked with a lot of dudes, just like too many dudes. And I'm glad that there are more women, but the whole system of it is, I don't know. I worry about how it's been affected by COVID, about how the landscape of traveling and whatnot will be, and, you know, how that can continue in a, what I really enjoy are things where, you know, specials have come out on Netflix and whatnot. Like the Tig Notaro with the animation, right? Great.
Oh, that was so
what a
good.
Wonderful post-COVID idea. Like, that gets what we're looking for out of it. Or like even in, you know, Bo Burnham's Inside. That's a different kind. Is it a comedy special? Yeah, it totally is. Different setup. Didn't require these kinds of things. Though that being said, it's kind of back to what you were saying before when it comes to, if they're not going to change the rules, they're just going to keep gatekeeping and telling people that women aren't funny forever. And we just have to create our own things. And it is hard when we imagine that we have to like create our own things and then hope somebody buys it so that we can make money off of it. And it's, from a creative standpoint, I think the idea of making something and creating it is good in and of itself, because like you are using the energies that are part of you to create this story, and that whether it reaches a small audience or a large audience, it's still worth it to put out there in the world. But it does suck that there are still gatekeeping assholes that are keeping these wonderful, beautiful, amazing stories away from a larger audience, people who might truly be able to benefit from the messages and whatnot. And I hope that there are more people out there writing, and hopefully the art renaissance that I've found with COVID is that I feel like people are connecting in across the world a little bit more. So like writing groups and production companies are coming up with ways to do projects when they like never would have met in the real world, like never ever. But it's like, this guy was in Tennessee and he was on this website and they both liked the same movie and now they're friends, and this guy in Madrid and this guy in Kentucky are all getting together and making a movie. And it's like, what? And it's just because we had this moment where it was like, where can I get social? I can get it online. And now people are creating these projects. And I, for art in a cultural sense, I think it's going to be beautiful. And I look forward to the collaborations and see how it goes. How does the business going to deal with it? What's the backlash of the gatekeepers? Are they going to whine and cry and be like, no, we're still going to do it our way? Probably. But, you know, we'll have to figure out another way around that. And, you know, maybe some of that is for us to, like I mentioned, you should start a school and teach them how to do stuff. But, you know, all jokes aside, it would be helpful, you know, with the stuff that you've learned from your experience to be like, okay, guys, these are things you're going to encounter. Watch out for this. This is how you can handle that. Sidestep this argument because they're never going to listen. Like things where, I mean, I wish it, I'm from Boston. I've got anger deep, deep, deep inside of me. I wish someone had told me not to argue like way more in my life. Like there's so much that I'm constantly like really mad about and I try to put some work out there to help and then nothing, you know? And it's like super frustrating, but you know, that doesn't mean not to try. That doesn't mean that my and your specific skill isn't in this storytelling, isn't in this creating something to be put out there and received and, you know, taken for whatever that person needs it. You know, I've heard there's this song where it's like I can't remember the name of the song. It's by Ani DiFranco. It's about how you can either listen to her songs for what she's saying she had in her life experience, or you can look at it as if it's a mirror and see it for what it reflects to you about what your experience is. Either way, art is experienced that it's out there and it's good. You can put the words out there, put your creation out there. To that end, I'd like to get into quickly before we wrap up. We've talked a lot about, you know, your journey to creating and that you got that Spotify deal. But tell me more about your podcast, both like what inspired you to create it based on the topic. And then since you and I are pals, I know I'm very fascinated to hear how the bigger community of it, the team that you now have, how that all came together.
My show is called FOGO, Fear of Going Outside. It's a nature show by the most reluctant host ever, which is me, because I am not an outdoor person. I'm definitely an indoor person. My exercise is I'd rather go clubbing. My scenery is I want to be inside a museum. My, you know, my life experience is like I want to be inside restaurants. I like to be indoors. I think because of my family history, I never get tired of clean water. I never get tired of air conditioning. I never take for granted, you know, the systems that we have built in order to keep ourselves safe from like tigers and stuff. So I came up with this idea because I actually really love nature shows. I love watching nature like on my couch, on the TV, you know, I watch them like they're just train wrecks about to happen. I love the trashy ones, like, you know, redneck hand fishing, I think hillbilly hand fishing, river monsters, serious ones like Alone, you know, Bear Grylls stuff, obviously every David Attenborough documentary ever made. I love that stuff. And I had gotten into podcasting actually because of my first child. I was breastfeeding and it was so, childbirth is so overrated. Breastfeeding is very underrated. Breastfeeding is terrible. It's so time consuming. It is physically and emotionally demanding. It feels like torture. And because I needed to use the hands and because I needed to be very, you know, aware of what was going on and positioning of my body and my kiddo and all that kind of stuff, I got into podcasts. I was consuming so much podcasts, so much podcast content and listening to all these really interesting shows that I was like, oh, I want to make a podcast. So I started a list on my phone of podcast ideas. I probably had like 200 ideas when the call for pitches came from Spotify for their Sound Up podcast accelerator. It was their first one. They'd never done anything like it. Nobody else had really done anything quite like it before. Now every kind of platform has one of these, you know, annual call for ideas from underrepresented voices, new voices to podcasting or whatever. They all have them now. But back then, they didn't have any of those. So it was the first one. Everybody was watching it, watching how it was going to play out. And I think because that one is focused on women of color, I felt the pressure because there are all these Hunger Games types things. You know, we feel the scarcity that I'm like, well, if I got such an amazing opportunity, I would have to do something capital I important. And I wrote up all these new ideas about, you know, maternal mortality and gentrification and, you know, just like important topics to my community, you know? And I was looking at them and I was like, I'm a fun person. I wouldn't listen to any of these podcasts. And I'm so tired of being only allowed to speak when it's about my trauma. I'm a fun person, you know? Why am I not? I just want to be a fun person because that's who I actually am. What's an idea? What's a show where my cultural perspective is very relevant? My perspective as a woman, my perspective as a woman of color, right, a queer woman of color is very salient, but it's not about the trauma of that identity, you know, and how it fits in the society. And that's when I was like, oh, like, I love nature shows. And my perspective on nature is extremely informed by the intersectional identities that I hold, you know, like, and I want to make the nature show that I want to see. Like, I see these people doing these things on the show and they're like, oh, and it's like so great. Or like mountain climbing, it feels so exhilarating or like whatever. I'm like, does it really? Really? So, you know, did any of the animals really look like that? Or did you edit up the color and post, you know, like, is it really the scenic or is it actually miserable? I'm very skeptical. I can't stop watching, but I'm very skeptical. I'm going to pitch this show about a nature show from my perspective. And they gave, so I was one of the 10 people out of 18,000 applications that was selected to be in their first kind of beta test of this program. But I wasn't one of the three people who got funding. Like, so we had like a pitch competition at the end of it. I wasn't one of the three people who won anything at the end of it. But it was fine. You know, it was fine. I was like, I got to meet all these other, you know, the other 9 women were just so fun and cool and supportive. And it's so rare to get a chance to be in a room just full of women of color who know how to tell stories. It was just so fun, you know, to be with each other. Forget the program. It was just so fun to be with each other. You know, it was totally like worth it. And I went and did a Kickstarter. So the Kickstarter obviously was very comedy oriented. And that was the year I told you, I'm like, I made as much money from comedy between the storytelling shows and the Kickstarters and like some writing things I did or whatever. I made as much money from comedy as I did from business consulting that year. Well, just like trying to pick up gigs, you know, it's partly that Kickstarter, we were able to fund it. And that's the money that I used to get sound. I didn't have any sound equipment even, much less. And I certainly didn't have any camping equipment. So I didn't have anything. So I raised the money on Kickstarter. My brother helped me make the video and he was in town. And we got to fund it. And it took me, I think, a year and a half to go do all the adventures that you end up hearing in the show and making the pilot episode. And then obviously shopping the pilot episode around to networks before I landed with Spotify. But yeah, that's the perspective. Really funny. Actually, a lot of outdoor people have found the show. So like, indoor people really love the show because I'm a nature show host that you can trust. Like, I tell you what the real deal is, you know. But actually, outdoor people, their minds are blown by the show because for them, it's like a really dramatically different perspective about the outdoors that they've ever even considered, you know. So it's just so funny. I get these follows on Instagram at Fogo Podcast, and they'll be like Hunter and... They'll Instagram will be like go there. Hunting trips are like just people I never would have had access to in my real life. These really outdoorsy archery, you know, skeeters, like people, I don't know real people like this, you know, and they're like, fine. I'm like, how did these people find this show?
Yeah, that's so great that you're connecting with all the different groups. That's so fun. That's so fun. I love that. I also love this idea that the outdoor people are like expanding their brain to understand a different perspective. You know, there's that idea is true for so many different aspects of life. But the idea of a hobby that you are truly connected to and to find a person who's like, I absolutely never want to do this and not be like angry with them, but instead just be like super fascinated by like what they are. Wait, what's your experience? Oh, I get why you don't want to do it then. Like, you know, as opposed to a lot of times, you know, you'll meet somebody and they're like, no, it's not a big deal. It's just like ski down the mountain. And I'm like, I am not interested in skiing down the mountain. No, thank you.
Yeah, like famous people have died.
Yeah.
From blocking their heads. Famous
people. There's a lot of things that have happened. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in New England. There were a lot of people asking me to ski and I didn't ski. Mm-mm. No, thank you. No, thank you. As a child, I went down icy and snowy hills on toboggans, and that was dangerous and insane. Why would I do it while standing? No, thank you. At least sitting, you can keep yourself in. You know, you can, and you fall, and you're like, it's okay. But you're standing up, so much to hit, so much to hurt. No.
Could you explain to me what a toboggan is real quick?
Oh, sorry. It's like the... what do you call it? It's like a sled that you, I just called it toboggan because any kind of like sled, sometimes it's a plastic, little, almost like a kiddie pool, but a little less on the sides. Sometimes it's wooden with handles on the sides and you just slide down the snowy hill and, head towards your death. And hope it works out. And it's usually at golf courses. When I was growing up, we went to golf courses because they had these big hills, and you could go down them and, you know, everything was covered in snow for a long time and then eventually ice. So, yeah, I mean, it's a dangerous scenario, but we did it as children. And I was like, hey, guys, I've learned that lesson. No, thank you. No, thank you. I'll have a hot cocoa in the lodge. Thanks so much.
Indoors. We have to stay inside.
Yeah. Sit next to this fire and chat with every stranger that walks by. It's going to be great.
chatting with strangers part, that was the least Northeasterner part of that entire story.
Sure.
That's
well,
Texas seeping in.
Yeah. I live in Texas now. I moved out of Boston at 18. So I've had more years outside of Massachusetts. So my life, it was just sort of my childhood up in the cold. And then I was like, no, thank you. I'm going to go to the warm now. Thank you. If I'm going to be cold, it's going to be manufactured and I'm going to pay for it.
You're such a rebel.
Oh, and that's why you should be in comedy, because that is ridiculous. Oh, man, you are funny. So final question. Thank you so much for being with me and spending the time today. Tell me, it's been a wild period of time. You have worked so hard on creating your podcast. You have marketed it. It's all been coming out. Everything has been super on point, excellent content, good marketing. But like, what are you doing now that is filling up your creative cup? What's the thing? What's the project that you're currently excited about that you're working on for the future? And no spoilers if you don't.
Right.
But, you know, what makes you feel good and creative and what's inspiring you for the next step in your creative life?
Well, I am determined with the new job that I just started after the conclusion of season one of Fogo. I'm determined to not let it keep me from doing the arts. So I'm trying to find babysitters so that I can go out and do some stand up. And I'm determined to write, you know, you write several minutes for your set. And I'm determined to kind of get one polished minute, one solid minute each week for my future stand up special, which I will probably have to produce myself and then get it picked up right like afterwards. And I also just started taking a sketch comedy writing class at Cold Town Theater here in town. It's an online class, or they're doing it via Zoom. So actually, we have students from all over the country, not the world, just the country, taking that class together. And the reason why I wanted to take it is because I am working on a script about a ninja who wants to get out of the assassin game and go to coding camp to improve her life. And it is not a, I love those shoot 'em up, I love John Wick, I love Kill Bill, I love all those. It's not like a revenge film. It's not a gotta do one last kill to get out of the business, you know, like kind of movie. Frankly, because I can't afford to shoot that kind of movie. So it's just a movie about how hard it is for any human being to dramatically change their lives and all the things that hold them back, you know, from it. And certainly for her, you know, she's got friends who are offended that she's picking something different, family that maybe puts too much on her shoulders. She has, you know, obviously credential obstacles because she's learned how to be a ninja. She definitely is not like, she's not that good at math, you know, to be able to test into things. She's, you know, has to deal with, she just has to deal with like the things that all of us have to deal with, except she's a ninja and she wants to get out of the business and improve her life. So the reason, and it sounds like the show Barry, but it's so Asian, so much more Asian, than Barry, and a little bit, and very tonally different than what Barry has to go through. But you know, I feel like these kinds of hyper violent comedy ideas are having a moment, and I just love that. And I just want to write one that is just filled with characters that like everybody has to be cast, has to be an Asian American comedian, you know. And I want to do some of those action scenes, but like within budget. And so that's been really, really exciting to kind of use the unit of sketch comedy to give myself structure to write scenes for it every week. And of course, I'm trying to pitch, I'm trying to get season 2 going for Fogo the podcast, and trying to sell the TV show version.
Oh, man, that'd be great. I bet it'd be super fun to see you, you know, climb a mountain. I would watch that for sure. I was just watching Bear Grylls before we got on the Zoom. I was like, look at him climbing that mountain. It's so crazy. But yeah, I mean, it'd be much more fun, you know, to watch you do it. Or maybe we could get you on Running Wild. You'd be an excellent, like, guest to be on there.
Yeah, I'm not famous enough yet, but maybe one day.
Yeah.
I want to get... My goal is, yeah, because I'm starting later in life, just before I retire, I just want to be famous enough to get to do one thing that I actually like doing. I think everybody wants to pay me to do things I hate doing. But I just want to do one thing that I like before I'm too old to work anymore.
You want to do one thing. I feel like you need to get that, like, embroidered on the wall. And, like, I think everyone can identify with that, this idea that I just want to do one thing in my life that I want. Like, oh my God.
Something super comfortable, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. For sure. You know what? You know how you would send letters to magazines with, like, here's a pitch for an article that I should write? You should send pitches to writers where you're like, I'd really like to be in this kind of movie. Could you write that kind of movie? And I bet you, if you send enough of them, especially to people that maybe you don't know personally, they might be like, this is bold. I like this. I like what she's saying. I want to go for it, you know?
This is my pitch to all of the screenwriters, you know, whether you're a TV or a film. This is my pitch right here. This is the whole reason I'm having this conversation with Amy. Also because she bought a Fogo cup from the website. And I am very, very appreciative for supporting for that kind of very material and direct support of the show, Amy. I don't know if I've thanked you enough for that. Here's a pitch. Okay. I can dance. I look like I can't. I'm pretty thick for an Asian girl, okay? I look like I can't, but I can do martial arts and I can really dance. And I can improvise. And yeah, please write movie roles for me. let me be in your indie films.
This sounds like a perfect call to action for everybody. Yeah. Write
I
movies.
Show up on time.
Mm-hmm. She's very organized. She can organize a whole family, you guys. You've heard how on point she is. She's a business lady. You're getting it done. It's happening.
Yeah, there's going to be no drama on set with me, except on screen where you want it.
Or if you want that kind of stuff, I'm available to cause some. It's also all right.
Yeah.
I will eat the last Twinkie just to get everybody mad. If you need that, I'm available.
I'm a really good cook.
Oh,
you know,
really?
I can if your indie film's on a budget, I can also cater as well as act in your film.
Don't offer that. I'm cutting that out immediately. No one should make you cook to be in a movie. No. Oh, my God. I mean, you're so funny. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. Your energy is so overwhelmingly positive and kind. And I really just hope that people can, you know, hear the messages that you're putting out there as well, because your confidence is just so strengthening everything that you're saying, as far as the political discussions we've had about, you know, creating a world in which diversity doesn't have to fight one another to get their voice heard, about being able to create a cultural landscape that has room for everyone and whatever stories they need to tell in the moment. And also for just creating fun, funny situations and continuing to work hard and be a great creative. It's been great to talk to you. You've been an amazing guest, and thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Aw, thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me on and for buying that cup. FogoPodcast.com. You're the best.
FogoPodcast.com, where you too can have a cup that I have.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on YesButWhyPodcast.com, or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at HCUniversalNetwork.com.